Good morning. So hopefully you're here for CS3330. So I'm going to start by talking about what we're going to learn this semester. Then I'm going to go through a bit of logistics. And if we have time, I'll start some less overview-like material. So you may vaguely remember some indirect way coming across the idea of from 2150 that we have these layers of abstraction. Like in 2150, you may vaguely remember stuff with assembly or IBCM machine code. And that's a lot of what this course is going to be about. So we're going to talk about sort of going from sort of a higher level language. Our example of a higher level language is C. And you might say, well, C isn't very high level. And, well, yes, it's not. That's precisely why we're going to be using it. To something lower level like assembly, to something like machine code for that assembly, and then to the layer below that of like how do we build hardware. And you might say, well, you build hardware by taking a bunch of wires and things that like transistors and putting them together, but that's not actually how people build hardware. People build hardware with programming languages for hardware. And we're going to deal with a sort of toy slash educational one called HCLRS, which is broadly similar to the commercial ones, these commercial hardware design languages, except it's sort of specialized for this class and avoids a lot of complications that, you know, since most of you probably aren't looking to design a processor professionally, don't need to deal with. We're going to talk a little about how that corresponds to gates, transistors, and registers, but for the most part, you know, that's not what this class is about. We're going to kind of assume that someone's going to build the sort of components you may have learned about in 2330 if you took that, and we're going to use those to build something that actually does useful computation. So talking about this higher level language that we're using, so we're using C. I'd say, why are we using C? None of the courses I took before this use C. C is a really annoying language. And, well, there's two big reasons. So one reason is that it's almost a subset of C++, and in theory, you know C++ from 2150. I know that that's varying amounts of true, especially since some of you may have taken 2150 a long time ago. And it's a subset of C++, so it removes a bunch of tricky features, which are also tricky to explain how they like correspond to assembly. Which means that there's a direct correspondence from C to assembly that's fairly straightforward. And you might say, okay, so that's how the compiler works. There's a way of taking a C statement, converting it into assembly that's, you know, pretty obvious. There's nothing like classes involved to like complicate things. And yeah, that's great. And it's gonna help you understand the machine. You can like do a manual translation yourself and get something that works. But the idea that this is what compilers are actually doing is not really true, because compilers try to be a bit clever, and they don't need to do the most obvious, the most direct translation, and they don't. So they're going to do something that might be confusingly indirect. We'll talk a little about that, but the reason we're using C is because this direct translation exists, so rather than talking about assembly all the time and then talking about how that goes to the machine, we can look at a bit of a higher level with C, knowing that there's this very straightforward way of knowing, oh, that's probably going to be this bit of assembly when we need to figure that out on a case-by-case basis, rather than trying to figure out long strings of assembly, which no one really wants to do. So because of this, that we're going to use C and things like that, you're going to need an environment with like a C compiler for later assignments in this class, and a Unix-like environment generally. So other tools we're going to use, like that hardware design language, need a Unix-like environment. You should have department accounts. You should probably have them now. If you don't have them, you should tell me via email so I can make sure that happens. But I sent a list last week, including everyone on the wait list as of last week, so you should have a department account that can log in to the department-supported machines, which is SSHing into Portal, or NX, which is sort of a remote desktop thing, with instructions on the course website and how to do that. And it'd be good to have that working before the lab next week. There's no lab this week. This week is just please make sure that works for next week. And so the apartment machines, their Linux environment, 64-bit, which is what some assignments actually care about. I know some of you will want to use not Linux, and that mostly works. So most assignments, you can use the Windows subsystem for Linux if you know how to set that up on Windows. You can use OS X for most, but not all assignments, with the notable exception of the one that's next week. Our sort of policy is going to be that if you have trouble, we're probably going to tell you to use the department accounts, because we have IT staff who does tech support for that. And with 400 students, I don't want to have my TA spending their time doing tech support if there's other things they can be helping people with. Like, we'll do a best effort thing, but, you know, if there's 10 people behind you in an office hour queue, we're not going to figure out how to get a VM working on your laptop when the department accounts work. So, questions about environments for things? Okay. So, below that, we had this layer of assembly. And we're going to use 64-bit x86 assembly, which, again, in theory, you know from 2150. I know that's a bit theoretical, and because of that, we're going to do a little bit of review of assembly, and our assignment next week is about getting you up to speed on assembly. And the main reason why is because I want to be able to like show you assembly snippets and talk about that and talk about how we implement that in hardware without having us spending all our time figuring out what does this assembly mean and so on. So theory, you know it. I know in practice it's a bit sketchy. Also, I know that in 2150 you didn't use this syntax for assembly. It's just what's called AT&T syntax for x86 assembly versus Intel syntax. We'll talk about that later. And then machine code. And you might say, okay, so we're going to learn machine code. And so we're going to learn machine code for x86 64, right? And that's not what's written on the slide. So you might be wondering, why is that? Well, real x86 64 machine code is complicated. So it has just a lot of history. So it's complicated for stupid reasons. So like basically what happened is that there was the original like 16-bit 86 processors, and then they made them 32-bit, and then they made them 64-bit. And they tried to keep the machine code very similar as they did this, even though in the process they went from like 4 to 8 to 16 registers, and changed the width of all the registers and all sorts of other things. They just tried to keep the machine code very similar, and therefore it's complicated, and we don't really care about that sort of way of it being complicated. So we're going to use our textbooks, x86 64 subset, and its corresponding machine code in this class. You might say, okay, so it's a textbook, toy, not real machine code, therefore it's going to be very simple. And, well, it's going to be simple. It's not going to be as simple as what you've seen before. So if you remember IBCM from 2150, this has a lot of features that IBCM doesn't have that are kind of complicated. Some of them are kind of obvious, like there's more than one register. Kind of would not be very useful machine if we didn't have that. We have actually full conditional jumps. But we have some things which are complicated and which are complicated in ways that, like, not all machines actually do, as we'll learn later. So we have a variable length encoding, meaning that different instructions take up different amounts of space in the machine code. And we have stack manipulation instructions, like push and pop, which it turns out that not everyone making a processor decided to actually implement. Okay. And below that, we're going to have a hardware design language that's called HCLRS. That's built for this course. And as I said, hardware design languages are programming languages for hardware. So the idea is you write this program, which is typically like a text file, like normal programs you've written in other languages. But rather than compiling it to a program you execute in like on your laptop by like typing a command or clicking something, it turns into a description of how to build a piece of hardware. Now, we're not going to actually build physical pieces of hardware for various practical reasons. So we're going to have a simulator for what the hardware would do, and maybe omit some little details, you know, about making the hardware work that you'd actually need to worry about if you were physically building the hardware. But the idea of these programming languages is that the compiler produces a description of here's what the hardware, how you should build the piece of hardware. And people do this rather than like actually hand designing the hardware, placing all the transistors, placing the wires. They have a program do this for them so they can work at a higher level, just like you have a program that deals with your code so you don't have to like worry about all the instructions individually. And we're going to use a hardware design language that's based on 1AR textbook, which is this book, which is why it's required, because that we're going to follow those assignments pretty closely. We're going to use a slightly customized version of it. We'll talk about that more when we get there. So we're not using exactly the same thing that's in the textbook. We have our own variation that I think adds some features that make things a little bit easier to understand, more flexible, which is why we call it HCLRS. It's called HCLRS because it's something I wrote in Rust based on something that Luther Sirkanovich did before me. That's what we're going to use for those assignments, but they're going to be pretty close to what's the textbook's description of, you know, walking through building a processor for this Y86 machine code. So that's my overview of sort of our layers we're going to cover. Questions about this before we talk a little bit about how sort of our model of how processors work? Okay. So we're going to be talking about building processors, and when we think of having a processor, well, a machine is not just a processor. We need more stuff. And one thing we need is we need storage. We need at least memory, right? We need places to put our data to actually do useful work. And traditionally, memory is how we're going to do that. So we're going to have this model where our processor is connected to our memory. To start out with, we're going to say what we'll call a bus. So this is a communication line, and this is how the processor sends messages to and from memory, and that's how it's going to communicate. So if the processor wants to get data from memory, it's going to send an address on that bus, and back on that bus, the memory is going to send back, hey, here's that data you were looking for. Sorry about that. So we're also going to be able to write data that way. We can send data, an address, and some data to write to memory. So this is sort of our model of how processors communicate with memory. So is this enough for a workable computer? People seem skeptical, so what are we missing? I.O. And a model of how we can add I.O. to this is, well, one thing we could do is we could say, well, the processor can have another way to communicate to I.O. devices, but we can avoid adding extra stuff. And we'll have, in this model, what we'll call an I.O. bridge, which will be on this same bus. So there's one bus out of the processor, or the processor sends data or receives data, and this can go either to memory or to I.O. devices, to keyboards, to network devices, to the mouse, and so on. And what we'd imagine is that we could have the same interface, that we send an address And the I.O. bridge here is just some piece of hardware that looks at that address and says, is this an I.O. device thing, or is this a real memory thing, and decides where to send it, or where to get something back. Now, if this is how our processor works, let's think about how executing an instruction works. And something that often gets missed is you think of, oh, memory is where we store data. Memory is not just where we store data, it's where we store our code, our machine code. So if we think of executing an instruction, our processor is going to say, okay, I have a program counter that's the address of the current instruction I'm executing, and I'm going to send that on this bus here. So I'm going to say, okay, I'm executing instruction at address 4000. I'm going to send that on this bus. The I.O. bridge is hopefully going to say, oh, that's for real memory. It's going to get the value for memory, and memory is going to send back the machine code for the instruction. In this case, I've written it as assembly, but really we're going to get something that's a little more friendly for the hardware. Like, you probably don't want to build something in the hardware that actually looks for a P followed by U followed by an S. You could do that, but that's probably not going to be very efficient. So probably we're looking for something a little easier for the hardware to interpret. And when the CPU gets this back, it's going to look at that and say, okay, what do I do now? And it's going to do some work. And in this case, this is a push instruction. So it's going to need to say, okay, I want to write a value to the stack. How do I write a value to the stack? Well, where is the stack stored? It's going to be stored in this memory over here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to send the address I want to write to, which I'm going to have stored in registers over here. So we have registers. And this, so far, must include at least the PC, the stack pointer, and this register we named REP. It probably includes a bunch of other registers. And based on that, we send, okay, here's the value to store, here's where to store it. And the memory actually does that and somehow signals that it was stored. And then we're done executing that instruction, so what do we do next? We go on to the following instruction. So we set the PC to point to the next piece of machine code we want, and send that to the memory and keep going. And this is what our processors are doing. They're doing this loop where they fetch one instruction, interpret it, possibly communicating more with the memory based on that, and keep going. So questions about this process? So since we all see that, whoops. So let's say we're executing an instruction that reads from this memory location into RAX. How many times during the execution of this instruction do we expect the processor to send something on that bus to the memory with this model I've just showed you? So anyone with an answer? How many times are we going to send something?
Twice.
Yeah. Twice? Okay. What are your two times?
Once for the program counter and the second time for the instruction.
So program, what do you mean for the program counter? So yeah, so the program counter, which is so the address of the instruction, sounds good. And the second you said for the instruction. So we're not sending the address on the instruction there, since we already did that. So what are we sending?
The address of the source and destination of the move.
Okay, so you said the address of the source and destination of the move. Okay, so yeah, we need to send something about this move up, the actual operation we're doing. So with this particular operation, can someone be more specific about exactly what we need to send to for that? What does the memory need to know about this move operation? and I, oh, I wrote the Intel syntax wrong. That is not very nice of me. Sorry about that. That's what I get for making this at the last minute. So yeah, the Intel syntax should be move RAX brackets that address. Yes. Okay, so we need to send, is it read or write? We have the instruction, which one is it? So in Intel syntax, destination is first. So this is a read, but indeed AT&T syntax is reversed, which would be a good reason to be confused about that given what you learned in 2150. So this is a read. So what? That's one piece of information we need to send, yeah. And what else? What do we need to send with our read to make it happen? What does the memory need to know? Yeah.
What it's reading.
What it's reading. And so we need the address to read from. From which is this address here. So we're going to get that address, which is presumably going to be in the machine code, and we're going to send it back saying, hey, read this now. And you'll notice that we didn't actually send anything about RAX to the memory. And why? Because the memory doesn't have our registers. That's on the processor, not on the memory. So questions about this exercise? Sure if people are bored or confused, so. Yeah.
So it is sent twice?
So what is sent twice? Which is sent twice? The address?
No, we asked how many times the message was sent from the processor to the memory.
Yeah, so two messages are sent from the processor to the memory. Yeah, one to get the instruction, one to get the data, the instruction reads. And they're both just requesting data. They aren't actually, you know, having the memory store anything. Because this instruction doesn't do that. Other questions? Yes?
So the reason we're not sending sort of the second half of that move operation is
yes, so the processor somewhere in here has RAX, the PC, and so on. So we don't need to send a message all the way over to the memory to access those. Yeah?
So is the primary relationship with the processor and the memory is just the processor asking memory for data or information?
The question is the primary relationship with the processor memory, processor asking memory for data and information, it's asking for data and sending data to store. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I'll have our interlude on some logistical topics, but starting with another motivational topic, which is why should you care about this class if you don't care about hardware? Which maybe you do, that's great. I know some people aren't excited about hardware and say, well, I'm never going to deal with anything lower level than Python. You know, why should I, you know, care about this class? And there's a bunch of reasons why, even if you aren't like going to be designing hardware or anything that's particularly close to the hardware, you might actually want to know what hardware does. And we're going to address these specially in this class. So one of these is program performance. So you might think, okay, I know about assembly, so I kind of know about program performance. I know how things turn into instructions. And your model would be, okay, well, if it's more instructions, it's going to be slower. And, well, that's a good first step, but with modern fancy hardware designs, that model doesn't work as well as you'd imagine. It actually breaks down quite often, and there's two big reasons why just counting the number of instructions that run gives you a surprisingly poor estimate of performance. And these are two things that exist in modern hardware designs that we're going to talk about. So one is parallelism. So fast hardware is parallel. What I mean by that is hardware does multiple things at the same time. It executes different parts of multiple instructions or multiple instructions at the same time. And as a programmer, you can affect the speed of the hardware based on whether you give the hardware multiple things to do or not. Sometimes the hardware that can do multiple things at once just doesn't have the work because you wrote the program in a way where it can't do those things at once because, you know, it has to do one after the other the way your program works. So learning how to write programs where this is not true, where the hardware can find two things that it can do at once, will make your program faster and in ways that you won't notice from just counting instructions because, well, it's the same number of operations, but if, you know, all the operations can be done at the same time as another one, it's going to be twice as fast versus if that's not true. And there's, as we'll learn, lots of ways in which hardware does multiple things at once, not just, you know, the most obvious ones of like multiple processors or multiple cores. The other big way in which program performance, you know, doesn't match the counting instructions model is that processors do caching, that accessing things that were recently accessed is faster. And why this happens is that this model is kind of a simplification, that what I showed you is, oh, the processor needs to talk to memory in order to get data every time, and the processor does talk to memory, but this is actually pretty expensive. So to avoid doing this, the processor basically has, a cache, which I'll represent with a dollar sign for cache, that's a smaller, faster memory that it tries to hold the important parts of memory in order to avoid sending messages this far, which turns out to be slow. And we'll learn about that later on in much more detail. But the consequence of that is accessing things that are recently accessed is faster because they'll be in that small, fast memory. But if they're not there, we have to actually go to the slower memory. And you can write your programs in ways where you more often access things that you've recently accessed or less often access them. Now, these are things that affect your program performance that are things that are kind of in addition to the kind of things you learned about performance in other classes. So in other classes, you probably learned about like algorithmic efficiency, big O. And you know, we're not going to have big O changes to our performance from things we do in hardware, but these are things that you can do in addition to finding the right, you know, asymptotic efficiency. Yeah, that will get you additional performance and often quite a lot of it. So another thing we're going to talk explicitly about that's kind of related to the hardware is how compilers work and how linkers work. And you know, even if you're not thinking of building a compiler or linker, if you are, obviously this is really useful. If you aren't, you know, it should help you understand, you know, when something goes wrong, what is an undefined symbol, how does that work? We're going to talk about that sort of process of going from multiple assembly files to an executable, what's going on in that process. And also can help you with debugging, understanding, like, how did my code actually end up in the thing the debugger's dealing with, like why are things different or not. And another thing we'll deal with is how the hardware deals with exceptional situations and how it sort of interacts with operating systems in that case. And so one thing we'll learn about is like, so like what really happens in like a segmentation fault? Why does that happen? What's the hardware doing? What's the OS doing in that process? You know, why does a segmentation fault happen sometimes when I access memory I'm not supposed to, but not all the time? We'll kind of go over what's going on under the hood. That should help you get a better idea of what's going on there. Okay, so questions about these topics, sort of things that might be useful that you'll hopefully learn something about. Okay, so some logistics. So we're not going to check lecture or lab attendance. Barring technical difficulties, lectures are going to be recorded, and remote submission of lab is possible. So that's the policy here. We're not going to verify whether or not you were here. If you're not attending lectures, I recommend that you try to have a regular schedule of watching them, and you try to answer in lecture questions, and you write down questions you have and ask them some other time, office hours or elsewhere, or piazza or whatever. Coursework. So we have labs. Labs are going to be something you could do in lab. You can also do them on your own. Collaboration is permitted, so if you go to lab, work with people who are there, that's great. The TAs will also be there in lab, which is the main purpose of going there, is that you should be able to get help from TAs. And there's going to be some threshold, which will be full credit, and basically if you meet that, you'll get full credit. There's probably some partial credit for less than that. The intent of all the labs is that you can do them in the lab time, you know, without spending extra time. How this works for people varies. Because I'm not like checking if you're in lab, you know, if you spend 90 minutes and get nothing done, I can't give you credit because I don't know that you really did that. I don't have any way of knowing. Homework assignments are usually related to the previous week's lab and due before the next lab, and before 9:30 because that's when the first lab is. They are to be completed individually. So labs, you can collaborate. Homeworks, individual. Don't share code. Don't share pseudocode. Don't share your detailed notes for your code. You can talk generally about sort of conceptual things and so on, but they're individual assignments. There will also be weekly quizzes. I will go over what that will look like next time with the demo. They will be online, open book, open notes, on time to be completed before the Tuesday lecture, and they'll be released sometime after, in the evening on Thursdays, after the last Thursday lecture. And there will be a final exam, which should be in some room on our combined exam time, which is on the exam schedule. Combined meaning for both sections. There's this textbook I showed you. I've tried to make labs and homeworks match up to the lecture material, but sometimes, you know, we might cover something and the lab or homework on it will be like a week or two later, depending on how things work out. Just keep that in mind. So I mentioned quizzes. Quizzes generally will be from the lecture material. And the two lowest quiz grades will be dropped. So, late policy. So, for labs, we won't accept late submissions because sometimes I will release the lab solution tell people on the homework. And if I release the lab solution, it's really hard for me to accept late submissions generally. For homeworks, it's you'll get a 10% deduction if you're between 0 and 48 hours late. There's no sliding scale there. 47 is the same as 1 hour late. 15 for 48 to 72, and no credit otherwise. For quizzes, again, we'll release the answers after they're due, and also we'll discuss them in lecture, and I'd like to be able to do that. So generally, we won't accept late submissions. For all these things, if you have some sort of exceptional circumstance, sickness, and so on, family situations, let me know. We can often do something, you know, but can't do it if you don't ask for it. And obviously, it's easier to do those things if you ask me earlier when I have more options. Okay. For getting help, for non-real-time help, sort of the primary thing we'll be monitoring is Piazza. Labs will be in person in the location that's on schedule. I'm not going to enforce that you actually go to your lab, but if the lab's full, obviously people who are actually registered for that lab time will get priority, though that usually doesn't happen much. Office hours, we have a calendar on the website which will be populated next week. There's some this week which are mine, but usually not much demand for office hours this week. Some office hours will be in person, and some will be remote, as indicated on the calendar. Our plan is that basically after 7 p.m. and weekend office hours are all remote. And some scattering of others are remote, but others are in person. We might adjust this depending on what demand and availability looks like. We hope doing a split works out. We're not going to ever have a time where there's both in-person and remote office hours, because we don't want someone going to the office hour room and pulling out Discord. We think that would be really disruptive. So we're not going to do that. And I'm hoping that, you know, having online options will be useful. My observations from when we were teaching this fully online is that usually online office hours seem a bit less efficient. They have some advantages, but they seem a bit less efficient for this class. For online office hours and for office hours that are in person where TAs choose to use it, we have an online office hour queue that's linked off the website. And I guess I should note, the office hour queue that is online has the first few slots are actually when you came in. The later slots are sorted by last time help, and the TAs have the option of resorting it by last time helped. The intention of this is that you shouldn't get an advantage by signing up the night before for 9 a.m. office hours. So we won't stop you, but you'll probably get pushed based on when you were actually last helped, not based on signing up at 9 p.m. the night before on an all IQ that, obviously, if you got helped at, you know, midnight, you probably weren't there. Okay, so that's on logistics. Right, and the first lab and homework, which is next week, so next week's the lab, the homework is due the following week, is basically using a debugger or disassembler, or probably both, figuring out the correct input to the program. And this again is to look at x86-64 assembly. So if you think that was a long time ago, you may want to review it. We're going to talk a bit about it in class, but we're going to kind of assume, as I think sort of the most students kind of remember that, just giving you a warning. So questions about logistics? So we talked earlier about memory. And I had this idea that, oh, memory, we can read and write data by sending an address. But we should probably talk more about what memory is. And our model for memory is that it's this array of bytes where we assign each byte an address. And for this class, bytes are always going to be 8 bits. So it's an array of these 8-bit values. I'm showing you this in hexadecimal just for my convenience, but it's bits. And I've drawn this as a big table. And in this case, I've drawn the table with the numerically largest address on top and the numerically smallest address on bottom, but I could have drawn it the other way, and it's the same table. So it doesn't matter what order I draw the table in, it's the same data. That makes sense. So that's what it looks like. We have one question we need to answer, which is, well, when we're reading things from memory, we're usually not reading a byte. We're usually reading a larger value. And there's something you may remember from 2150, which was endianness, which is when we read multiple bytes as a single value, how do we decide how to interpret that? So, for example, here, I have some C code which takes this a value at this address here and reads it as an int. On our department machines, this int is going to be 4 bytes. So one question is, what 4 bytes? And the answer we're always going to use is that this address here is the numerically lowest of those 4 bytes. So we start at 42000, go to 42001, and so on to get those 4 bytes. But then we have another question, which is, well, what number is this? And there's 2 logical ideas. So one idea is that we can take the address at the the value at the lowest address, and we can say that that's the least significant part of the value. And the other is we can say it's the most significant part of the value. And real machines have chosen both of these options. They both have their advantages and disadvantages. And the first one is called little endian. So the way I remember this is that the least significant byte, the one that affects the value the least, where the ones place is, has the lowest address. The alternative is big endian, where the least significant byte has the highest address. In this class, we're always going to be dealing with machines that are little endian, so we're always going to be using this first option. So questions on little versus big endian here. Okay, so as I said, we always use little endian. So let's go through what this means for what actually happens in, say, some C code that has to deal with this. So this is a bit complicated, so we're going to walk through this code before we go to the answer here. So I have this buffer of 8 bytes, which I've drawn slots for 8 bytes here. And I have 2 32-bit values, value 1 and value 2. And I get pointers to those 32-bit values by doing a cast. And that's going to give me a pointer to the first byte, the numerically lowest address byte of those values. And so you'll need to apply what we just talked about with little endian as far as what what part of the address is, what's around it. And then what we do is we copy into the buffer the two values byte by byte. We copy value 1 to the first 4 bytes of the buffer, and we copy value 2 to the second 4 bytes of the buffer. That's what this loop does. And then, once we've done that, we filled the buffer with these two values, we read a value back from the buffer, but starting at index 1, not index 0. So in our buffer here, we have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And we're going to copy our value back into value 1, byte by byte, starting at index 1. And the question is, what do we read back? What is value 1 after we do this? So I'll give you a minute or so to think about this. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what happens. Okay, people would like more time. So let's see. So who thinks A? Show of heads. B, C, D, E, F, G, okay, H, I. So we have a split with people most confident about G and some people less confident about C and F. So any questions about confusion about what this code is supposed to do ignoring endianess issues that people have? Yes. Yes, so if we think of value 1 as being a 4-byte value, this, so we can like view it as a 4-byte value or a 4-byte value or like an array of 1-byte values. And what this cast does, at value 1 here is a pointer to it as an array, as 1 4-byte value. And then we convert that to a pointer to it as a 1-byte value. So that's a pointer to the part of it with the lowest address. And then later on, we kind of interpret that as an array of four values with like pointer value 1 index. Does that make sense? That's the compiler is responsible for doing that when we make this pointer.
Okay, so we don't need to.
Yeah, the compiler is going to the compiler stored value 1 somewhere. It's going to figure out that address and put it in a variable for us. So I should remember to repeat questions because I'm recording. Other sort of questions about non-communities? Yes. Question, value 1 and value 2 are 32-bit integers? Yes, and that's because the uint32t type is always a 32-bit integer.
I'm a little confused because I thought that x value would be just like each hex is 2 bytes, right?
Each hex, so 2 hexadecimal nibbles are 1 byte. Because each hexadecimal nibble can store 4 bits. Other questions? Yes.
Why are we indexing the pointer value 1? Is that a pointer, and how do you index the pointer?
Question is, how can you index a pointer, because you're thinking, it's a pointer to one thing. So we can always treat pointers as kind of like arrays syntactically in C. And what this is equivalent to, just as a rule, is that we could have also written this as star pointer value 1 plus I. So what it does is it adds I to the pointer and then dereferences that. So it's the value next to it in memory, right? Because we're taking the address. And a rule about pointer arithmetic in C and C++ is that when we add one or two to a pointer, we add one or two of the thing the pointer points to. So we increment the pointer by the size of I unsigned chars. Unsigned chars are 1 byte, but if this was a pointer to something bigger, we'd increment by more than 1 byte for value of I. Yeah?
Is there a reason we're casting into a character pointer instead of an integer pointer?
So the question is, why are we casting to an integer pointer than a character pointer? So this code is choosing to copy byte by byte just deliberately. So if we wanted to copy with larger pointers, we'd have to deal somehow with the mismatch between this buffer size, the size of the buffer elements, which are 1 byte, and the size of these integers here. And the way this code has chosen to do it is by converting everything to bytes. Other questions? And again, I forgot to repeat questions. Please, I should remind me to do that. Okay, so let's go over the endianness part. And I have my working through this part of this. So we start out with these two values, and in little endian, the lowest address contains the least significant part, which is the ones place. So in this case, the least significant byte is hex 78 for value 1 and hex F0 for value 2. Then we copy those to different parts of the buffer. And we get our buffer filled like this. So. Okay, so questions about this part so far? So finally, we're going to extract part of this buffer and can move it back into value 1. And that part starts at index 1 because I starts at 0 plus 1. So we select these bytes here. And we, copy from index 1 to 0, from index 2 to 1, and so on. And then we have to interpret this back as little endian. So the ones place is going to be in index 0, so it's going to end with 5, 6 there. So, questions? Yes?
If it had overwritten the buffer, would it have just put the escape code in there? I forget what the heck.
If
our pointer was overwriting value 1 and it had gone past the buffer, would it have just put the x value in there for a char?
So you're asking if it went past the end. Where would it go past the end of the buffer? Is this in the second loop or the first loop?
The second loop where it's doing is writing everything back into value 1.
Yeah.
If it had, say, started at position 5 and gone to 8.
Okay. So you're asking, here we were off by 1, but we stayed in the buffer. What if we were instead had like I plus 5? Well, in that case, we'd seem to be selecting, this. So what would happen there? And this is what is known as undefined behavior. You're accessing something that's out of bounds, and that is not allowed. And the compiler is allowed to generate code that does anything it wants. So it could seg fault. It could put a random number. It could decide that this code, since it goes out of bounds, can't possibly be reachable, so we'll just omit it. It can do whatever it wants. What makes sense to happen is that if we were doing the natural assembly translation, there's going to be something in memory here, and that's what you'd access. Or it would be out of bounds, and you get a seg fault. But the C specification says the compiler can be clever about this and say, that's not allowed, so you can do whatever it wants. Yes?
In the context of for loop, is plus plus I do anything different than I plus plus?
The question, does plus plus I do anything different than I plus plus? No. Yes?
In a real system, will the operating system or something try to prevent poorly written code from messing with the allocated memory for other programs and prevent it from just accidentally overwriting it?
The question is, I talked about that, that the natural thing to happen if we go outside the buffer is we access whatever memory's there. Yes, as we'll talk about much later in the semester when we talk about something called virtual memory, typically the only thing you could access is what's other parts of your own memory, your own program's memory, and that's enforced by a mechanism called virtual memory, which is what leads to something you've probably seen called a segmentation fault. We'll talk about that much, much later in the semester. We'll talk about the hardware mechanism that allows operating systems to do that. Other questions about this exercise? Yeah. Sure. So this is the code is reproduced here except for the beginning. So the beginning here, we declare array of characters, array of bytes of size 8. And we have two integers, which are 4 bytes each. And we get pointers to the integers, but the pointers are telling the compiler to interpret the integers as a bunch of bytes instead of integers. And then we copy from that those bunches of bytes that are actually the integers into the beginning of the buffer and halfway into the buffer. That's what this loop here does, which now we're over here. So I have a color-coded diagram, which is that same loop. That there. And then the second loop, we copy back from starting at 1 and into, again, it's the integer, but we're interpreting it as the bytes. And that's the last loop there. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay. And back there. Question is, if we were decrementing in the for loop instead of incrementing, would it read left? What do you mean, read left to right?
When we put it back in, when we put the value in the buffer back into value 1.
Okay, so the question is, if we did this for loop in the opposite, this for loop here in the opposite order, what matters is the correlation between this index and this index. Right. So if we do that in a different order, we'll still end up with the same set of bytes here. But if we, copied from 1 to 3 instead of 1 to 0, then yeah, we get a different answer. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if we had just copied the integer without changing it to bytes, would it have just copied in order? So how are you proposing to do that copy? So the issue here is that buffer is the wrong type, right? It's not an integer type. So the compiler, if we do that, will either say, oh, you want to convert this integer to 1 byte by truncating it, or it will, you have to do something to tell the compiler that they're really integers. So if you were, say, assigning from value 1 to value 2, you might be wondering, saying, okay, how does that happen? Does that happen in a particular order? And the answer is, well, you have no way of knowing. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's on endianness. So I know endianness is probably one of the more confusing things from 2150. The rule you need to remember for this class is least significant byte is always the lowest address, because we're always going to use little endian. And you'll notice that I carefully avoided introducing endianness as a left to right or right to left thing. I always talk about how it corresponds to addresses, because if we have a value that we don't split up into parts, there's no endianness. It's just a value. We don't have parts. We don't have to worry about which part is least or most significant, because there's only one part. So this means in particular that registers don't have endianness unless we can access different parts of the register by addresses, but we can't do that. We just have RAX. That's a register. You can't access, byte 3 of RAX. That's not a thing. Okay, so in our last 10 minutes, I'm going to start by doing a bit of assembly review. So in this class, we're going to use AT&T syntax assembly instead of Intel syntax assembly. And you might say, why are we doing that? Well, part of it is because our textbook does. Part of it is because it's the default for the tools on Linux, which is what we'll be using. So I'm going to briefly go over what's different. So I have some examples here of AT&T syntax assembly and Intel syntax. And I'm going to go through the rules first, and then we'll look back at these examples. Well, I guess I'll go through the examples individually. So here's our first example here. So this is assembly for move into memory an address at the address stored in RBX. So use RBX to access memory. And RBX is a memory address. And store the value 42, which is an 8-byte value there. That's what this instruction does. In Intel syntax, you can write it move the keyword to say it's 8 bytes. Pointer from RBX, the value 42. In AT&T syntax, looks like this. So what are all these parts? So first notable thing here is that the destination is last. So in AT&T syntax, the destination of an instruction is always the last operand. A way I like remembering this is you can think of kind of replacing the last comma with an arrow pointing to the right to like visualize what the instruction does. So this takes 42 and moves it into there. We have parentheses whenever there's a value in memory. As we'll learn later, that's not actually the rule, but it's usually, you know, whenever you see parentheses, we're accessing memory, but there's other cases where we're accessing memory. We'll look at them later. When we're not accessing memory, we have some special characters to indicate that. So this dollar sign here represents a constant. If there's no dollar sign, it means something different. In fact, it means accessing memory at the address 42 instead of using the value 42. Whenever we have registers, they always start with a percent sign. If they don't start with a percent sign, it's a label. So if we just wrote RBX without a percent, that would mean something we put where we put RBX colon earlier in our assembly code, which obviously wouldn't make sense, but you know, that's what the assembler is going to be looking for if you don't have a percent sign. And this Q here represents the length that the instruction acts on. So this instruction is a 8-byte instruction, so Q for quad. And non-intuitively, L is 4 bytes for long, W for word is 2 bytes, and B for byte is 1 byte. And often you'll see this omitted. In this case, we can't do it because there's an instruction to move 8 bytes to a memory location. There's an instruction to move a 4-byte constant to a memory location, and so on. You have to say which one we want. So questions about this example here?
Could you repeat again what 42 would be if you didn't have the dollar sign in front of it?
So question is, can I repeat what 42 would be without the dollar sign? So this instruction, this is not a legal instruction, but say this instruction here is RBX gets memory at address 42. So 42 without the dollar sign is memory at that address, which is usually a mistake. Yes? So the question is this the same as if I wrote 42 with parentheses? So if we did parentheses 42 RBX, this is a syntax error. So other questions? Yeah. So parentheses around RBX here indicates that it's accessing memory. So if I had the, so if I did move Q 42 to no parentheses RBX, This is just writing. This doesn't access memory. It just copies 42 into RBX. So the parentheses indicate we're accessing memory using RBX, not accessing RBX directly. The reason I didn't, when someone went an example without a dollar sign, write 42 comma parentheses RBX is that there's no memory to memory move instruction. So that wouldn't assemble. Other questions? Okay. So this is sort of a simple example of accessing memory. And there's a more general form, which is a bit more confusing. So here, we access memory at the address, which we compute by taking RBX, adding RCX multiplied times 4, and 100. And you can see that the syntax that they chose is that we put the value we add before the parentheses. And you can think of the example I showed you where we just access address 42 by putting a 42 as, well, we omitted the parentheses because we aren't adding anything to it, but we start with that value 42, which we add to nothing. That's sort of the general idea of the syntax. But usually you take like a constant and add it to something from a register, like say the stack pointer, to access something on the stack. And we have what Intel calls a base register. So this register is a base address and an index address. And they call this an index address because this is kind of like what you do for an array access. And that's why the hardware supports this as part of an instruction, is because this is useful for accessing things like arrays. If RCX is an array index and array elements are 4 bytes, this computes the address of something in that array. And in AT&T syntax, we kind of have these 4 slots here that we can fill. In Intel syntax, you kind of write a formula, and you just have to know that some formulas fit with that 4-slot idea and will assemble, and some won't. In AT&T syntax, they kind of made it more directly correspond to what is actually going to be encoded in the machine code. So questions about the syntax here? Yes. So saying, like, why is it not consistent? I think the way this was designed is that they said, we have these 4 different values that you need to specify, and we have this convention, we always put the constants before the parentheses, and the rest we just put in order that they're roughly used. But yes, it has some disadvantages versus the Intel syntax in the respect of, you kind of have to look up or memorize which goes where. Yeah?
So let's say you just wanted to multiply a constant with the value in a register, but you just wanted to add 2 registers. Would you just have a 2-item parentheses?
The question is, can I omit operands? And the answer is absolutely, which is the next slide. So there's a bunch of versions where you just don't include everything, and they work. Where basically the values you omit don't figure, this is sort of exactly the way that happens. Other questions? Yeah?
If you multiply the RBX by 8, does it just get to a completely different address?
So if I change this 4 to an 8, do I get completely different address? Yeah. So generally, you choose this value to match like the type of array or similar you're using. And I guess I'm not quite out of time. I guess I should note that this value here, this has to be 1, 2, 4, or 8. No other values are supported. If you want something else, you have to use a multiply instruction. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. We'll put this more assembly stuff up on Thursday.